The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest, Lucy Dillion, read English at Cambridge before becoming a press assistant in London and then a junior fiction editor. She won the Romantic Novelists Association Contemporary Romantic Novel Prize in 2015 for 100 Pieces of Me. Her latest novel is Where the Light Gets In. Also joining us is Victor Dixon, who's the author of three series for children and teenagers and is twice the winner of the most prestigious science fiction and fantasy award in France. The blockbuster series is now translated into English. The first book, Ascension, features the world's craziest speed dating show ever, aimed at creating the first human colony on Mars. We also have G.J. Morgan, who's been a chef, a fashion graduate, and now he works in finance. His debut novels, His American Classic and Her American Classic, are told from dual perspectives and is an emotionally driven love story. And finally on tonight's book show is Shelley Unwin, the children's book author from Australia. Her first series of five picture books, Your One to Your Five, came out last year and have been followed by a narrative non-fiction picture book called Blast Off. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Lucy Dillon, who won the Romantic Novelists Association Contemporary Romantic Novel Prize in 2015. That was for 100 Pieces of Me. She's also won the Romantic Novel of the Year Award in 2010 for Lost Dogs and Lonely Hearts. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Where the Light Gets In. Welcome to the book show, Lucy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Enjoying a rare bit of sunshine in London today.
Oh, how nice. Lovely. Yeah. Enjoy. So going back to the beginning for you, I know you read English at Cambridge and you were a press assistant in London and then a junior fiction editor. Do you think you've always wanted to work with words?
Yes, and I've always loved writing. I've always loved reading even more, I think. But publishing is definitely one of those industries where until you work in it, it all seems quite mysterious. And I mean, I always wanted to be a writer, but I had no idea as a child or as a student how you actually became a writer. So it's only when I got a job as an editorial assistant in a publishing house that I saw the kind of inside the box. And when you're working with people on a day-to-day basis, it's amazing how quickly the whole thing becomes unmysterious and quite unromantic. So it was kind of seeing how books edited and then how they're marketed and how much work actually goes into turning somebody's manuscript into a finished book that made me think, do you know, actually, I could have a go at doing this. You don't have to be Jane Austen straight out of the gate. So yes, it was really sort of, although I've always written, it was actually working in publishing that kind of gave me the nudge to get on and start writing my own book.
Good grounding, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly very illuminating. I think the thing that I learnt most is that the most important thing about having writing talent is it's not about spelling or grammar, because somebody can always fix that for you. It's about being able to capture a reader's imagination, or kind of creating characters that just lodge in readers' hearts. And you really do not have to be the best speller to do that. It's all about understanding people and understanding how people's imaginations work. It's far more important.
Yeah. And have you always known the kind of books you want to write?
I've always written the kind of books I want to read. And I think actually that's quite a key thing, that if you try and make yourself write in a genre that you're not really interested in yourself, it never quite kind of catches fire. So I've always wanted to write the books where I'm desperate to know what happens in the next chapter. And for me, that is that's kind of romantic novels, or novels about families, or about old houses, or about communities. So I've always kind of followed where my imagination's gone.
Is it difficult to come up with new stories in romantic comedy? Because you'd think people have been writing romantic comedy for years, and there's so many wonderful books and wonderful authors out there. Is it difficult to think of something new?
It's actually very difficult. It is very difficult in that, you know, people always say romantic novels are quite predictable because, you know, they always end up together in the end, which is something that nobody ever says that about crime novels. Oh, crime novels are so predictable. Somebody always gets murdered and somebody gets arrested.
good point. You know, but, very good point.
Yeah. It can be quite challenging coming up with new ways of kind of getting a couple from A to Z and finding new points for them to go around. But the one thing that I've kind of learned over the years from talking to people is that people have the most incredible stories, and the way in which people's marriages or relationships kind of start and then develop is way more strange than anything you could make up. So I'm kind of inspired by the fact that everybody I talk to tells me something, you know, quite incredible. It would itself make a great story. So I think it's just a case of listening to find those new versions.
Are you inspired every day? Do you keep a lot of notes?
I try to. It's quite awkward actually, because I think my brain is like a sort of big threshing machine. I'm sorry, a lot of my metaphors get quite agricultural because I live in the countryside. but I find that anything I read, or anything anybody tells me, or anything I see on the television just kind of gets churned up in my imagination. I sort of forget where I've heard it. So I have to be quite careful when friends tell me things, because that can just go in the big hay baler in my head. And quite often somebody said to me much later on, oh, I see you used that story about, you know, me and Steve, and I don't know what you mean, you know, and she'll regale the anecdote that's in the book, and I will have been convinced I actually saw that in my local paper. So I have to remember who's told me what. It can be really embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's why I never read other people's books when I'm on a deadline. I just can't read other people's books, because everything just goes into my head, and it's so easy to accidentally, you kind of borrow a phrase, or I'm not even borrow a phrase, but just for the phrase to pop up.
Yeah.
So you've got to be quite careful.
Do your friends trust you less since you've been an author then? I'm not going to tell Lucy, she'll put it in the book.
I do get a lot of that, but it's always about the most mundane stuff. And you always think in the back of your mind, yeah, well, if I could get a story out of that, I'd be doing all right.
Yeah.
I think now they've sort of got used to it. I think they think that if I was going to use any of their better stories, I would have done by now. So
yeah, fair enough. Well, that's good.
The trust has come back.
Glad you haven't lost friends over your job.
Not anymore, no.
Good. So let's talk about the new book then, Where the Light Gets In. Tell us about Betty and Lorna.
Lorna is a young woman who's coming back to her hometown after quite a long time away. All my novels are set in the same place. It's a small market town in the Midlands called Longhampton, which is made up. Lorna grew up there, and she has a lot of kind of family ghosts that are still wandering around. But she's determined to come back because her dream has always been to have an art gallery of her own. Her mother was a well-known illustrator. Lorna's always wanted to follow in her footsteps, but has come to realise she doesn't have the artistic talent, so she feels the next best thing will be to nurture other people's. And in order to get her art gallery off the ground, she decides that she needs a big exhibition, and there is only one famous artist in the Longhampton area, a lady called Joyce Rothery, who has been retired for a number of years, and she's a bit of a recluse. And Lorna attempts to persuade Joyce to let her hold a kind of celebration of her work in the gallery. And initially, Joyce just refuses. She's quite a grumpy old lady. But the way in which Lorna and Joyce gradually build their friendship is through Joyce's dog, which Lorna starts to take for walks. And as in a lot of my stories, dogs do have quite a kind of key role in building the human relationships. Mm. And it's really about how these two women from very, very different backgrounds, they're very different ages, they have a lot to teach each other and a lot to learn from each other. And it's a story about how that friendship grows into something quite beautiful and quite important for not just them, but also the town itself.
Lovely. You can see with friendships how age doesn't necessarily make a difference at all. We find that a lot here as expats. You tend to find yourself becoming friends with people and socialising with people who you may not if you were back in the UK. I've got lots of friends in the UK who hang around with people the same age as them, many of whom they've known for years and years. They went to school with or college with or have worked with for a long time, that kind of thing. But here you can end up becoming really good friends with someone 20 years older than you or younger than you, and it seems perfectly normal.
And it's so enriching as well.
Yeah.
You talk about things that are sometimes outside the normal kind of day-to-day sphere of, oh, you know, how are the kids at school and, you know, John's doing this at work. You talk about things that are actually quite surprising.
Mm.
I think it's a really healthy bond across the generations.
Yeah, it's a lovely idea, going to the extreme, it's a lovely idea that older people can really learn a lot from young people, whether it's to do with technology or things like that. But then young people can learn an awful lot from older people as well. If you can find friendship in someone completely opposite age-wise, you can learn a lot from each other.
Well, quite. And I think the trouble is when you're separated by those generations, there are quite a lot of preconceptions, I think, that often the media sort of, presents that, you know, all millennials are like this and all baby boomers are like that. And it's actually when you meet people in real life, you realise how that really isn't the case at all. And one of the things that I particularly liked when I was researching this book, I've always known about a charity called the Cinnamon Trust in the UK, which is a charity which arranges for people to walk dogs or look after cats for older people who might not be able to get out and about so easily. And it's a lovely way of finding something in common with somebody you might not necessarily ever meet, you know, a dog or a cat or a parakeet or whatever your pet specialisation is. And it's often just through having that little bond that other things can develop. And I guess much like being an expat, when you're in a community and, you know, you're kind of meeting people in different situations, you've got one thing in common, and that's just a good starting point.
Mm, I like that. I'll have a look into that, the Cinnamon Trust. So
yes, it's lovely.
Has the way that you've written books changed much over the years? Have you learned a lot from the early days?
Yes, I think it's a funny thing. At the beginning of every book, I always think, oh, I can't do this anymore. I used to think it was just me, but apparently quite a lot of writers have this, that you think, oh, I've used up all my ideas. and you never do. The thing I try and do now is just to be a bit more structured about how I write. And I have a big, I'm looking at it right now in my study, I have a big pin board and I break everything down by into acts and chapters, and I have little bits of card that I can move around. Just because I don't know whether it's a sign of creeping age, but I can't keep things in my head in quite the same way that I used to when I started. I need to see it all written down. And I find it easier to, particularly in a book that's got quite a complicated plot structure and lots of people, you need to know where everybody is. And I just find it easier to write it down in different colours.
Mm.
So that's kind of changed. But also I find that I'm kind of more trusting that the end will appear. I used to worry a lot that if I didn't know exactly how it's going to finish, it would be a problem. But now I think that quite a lot of characters reveal themselves to you while you're making them do things. So I just trust that they'll bring things to the right end.
Mm. So you don't plan exactly how the book's going to go before you start?
I plan quite a lot. The only thing I don't plan is the last quarter.
Okay.
Because I think sometimes if you plan to, it's different. I think if you're planning a crime novel, you absolutely do need to know how it finishes because you need to know who did it. I think with a novel that's driven by relationships and human emotions, there's a danger that if you decide how people will react in quite a rigid way and then plot the entire book according to those decisions, you can sometimes get halfway through and think, oh, actually, I don't know if I would throw him out, or I don't know if I would be able to move on so quickly. Then you realise that actually the rest of your book is now hinging on a decision that doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah.
So I think you need to be a little bit flexible about how things are going to end up and allow a bit of room for change.
That makes sense. Well, if people want to get a copy of Where the Light Gets In, it's out now and available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Lucy Dillon, who we've been chatting to today. Lucy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Talk Radio Europe.
Your voice in Spain.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the States is Victor Dixon. He's the author of three series for children and teenagers and is twice the winner of the Grand Prix de l'Imaginaire, the most prestigious science fiction and fantasy award in France. He's with us on the book show to talk about his series. It's been translated for the first time in English from French. The first one in the series is called Ascension. Welcome to the book show, Victor.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us. So what, you're from France, but you live in New York. How long have you been in New York?
It has been 2 years now. And before that, I was based in Singapore. So I've been around a little bit.
So you enjoy traveling?
Yes, I think it's fueled the inspiration, maybe.
Yeah. So why did you decide to put these books together and why were you aiming at children and teenagers?
Well, there are two big questions here. First, the reason why I write for teenagers or young adults, as we say today, I think it's a very interesting age in life where for the first time we make our own decisions and we decide who we want to be. And that's really what inspires me to write for this audience and about these characters who are in their late teen years. That's for the reason why I write young adults. And now the series itself, it's called The Phobos. There are two main inspirations. One of them is my fascination for space. Since I was a kid, I was always fascinated by stars and other worlds. And today, for the first time in human history, we have the means to go to another world, to go to Mars. It's going to happen very, very soon. I'm convinced about that. So I thought it was the time now to imagine this trip before it happens in real life. That's the first source of inspiration for Ascension. And the other one, I didn't go to space to find it, but here on Earth. It's all the screens that surround us, all the images, because it seems that our society is fascinated by images and screens, our smartphones, our reality TVs. So I thought, where would we have to go if we wanted to escape those screens? If we go to the other end of the solar system, is it far enough? For us, it's a question we can ask ourselves every day. But for the characters in my book, in Ascension, it's going to be very soon a question of life or death.
Wow. So it's the book involves six girls and six boys, and it's called the Genesis Program that they're involved in. And it's kind of like a speed dating show, but in space.
Exactly. Well, to give you the context of the story, it takes place in a very near future where the US government has gone bankrupt. So they had to sell all their assets, schools, museums, roads, you name it. They had to sell everything, including NASA, the National Space Agency. And the company that bought NASA decided to make a profit out of their investment right away. How? By creating the first ever human mission to Mars, but also world's craziest speed dating show on the Genesis Channel, as you said, that will be broadcasted to Earth 24 hours a day.
So tell me about these characters in the show.
Well, I have 12 main characters, 6 girls and 6 boys. They all come from a different country. Actually, I decided on the nationalities based on the countries today that invest the most in space conquests. So you have a French girl, you also have a British girl, Germany, and so on and so forth. And the thing is that they don't know each other. They never met before boarding on the spaceship. And they will have 5 months of travel to Mars to get to know each other through this speed dating game of 6 minutes each day. Hence the motto of the Genesis Channel, which is 6 girls on one side, 6 boys on the other side, 6 minutes to meet, an eternity to love. And that's precisely the point, because when they land on Mars, they will be officially married. They will have to start families right away and make babies, of course, in order to populate the Martian base. And they will be happy ever after. Or will they? Or will they?
Yeah, exactly. So 6 minutes a day. What happens in that 6 minutes then every day?
Well, I think the readers will have to read the book to discover one by one how it works, you know, how the couple are going to form. But it's very short, and at the same time it's very long. I think it's our society, the sense of time is quite fragmented, you know. We have notifications coming from our social media all the time, so I think it's quite relevant for our experience of time to have a very short, you know, session of 6 minutes each day to meet another human being, to try to meet another soul. Is it possible or not? My main character, Leonor, who is French, she thinks it's not possible before boarding on the spacecraft. Actually, she doesn't believe in love at all, and all she wants to do is to make history, but maybe her opinion is going to change during the trip.
I was going to say, is there a mixture of people who want to be on there for fame and to be on television and people who genuinely want to find love?
Exactly. That's exactly the point. I think it's divided quite equally in my crew of 12 astronauts, because between the one who board to find love, truly, and the one who just wants fame and appear on the big screens and be famous ever after.
Interesting. So there's 3 books in this series. We've also got Distortion and Collision. Can you tell us, without giving too much away, how the story evolves?
Well, you know, I like to keep the suspense. Phobos is a book that has a lot of romance, a lot of science fiction and adventure. But first of all, it's a thriller. And for thriller, you need to keep a bit of secrecy, I think. So I can just say that the tension is going to build up from one book to the other. And my goal when I write is that the reader cannot put the book down, and maybe has a very, very short night.
So how did you get to this point of writing the book? I know about your inspiration, but had you done any writing before? Had you taken any courses, or how did you do it?
Well, before being a writer, I always was an avid reader. And I think that's true for all writers. We like stories, we like to read, and we like them so much that we end up creating them. So this series, Phobos, is my 3rd series. Two first ones published in France are called The Strange Case of Jack Spark, which is urban fantasy, and Animal, which is a historical fantasy. And at one stage you have a story that becomes so important in your head you have to put it on the paper, and that was the case for me with Phobos.
And do you like setting out to write a series then? Do you enjoy that?
I think series give us the opportunity to go deeper in the characters' psychology and backstories, and also to build longer arcs or, you know, more expanded plots. Mm. And today, readers, they like this kind of long stories. But it's not only true for books. I think we have the same phenomenon on TV, you know, the huge success of TV series today. I think it's because people, they like to be immersed in long stories. And again, maybe that can be explained by something I said before about the time being so fragmented today. You know, everything goes faster, and we have so many things requiring our attention all the time, that when we we can have, you know, a long-term story where we get ourselves immersed in, it's kind of a relief.
Mm. And how long would you say you're spending writing each book?
When I start a new series, I would say I spent up to 2 years writing the first book, because there is a lot of research to do. And in the case of Phobos, I did a lot of technical research. I wanted to sound very, very real, based on the technologies we master today. And that's also the reason why we included in the books a number of drawings to explain the technology better. And when I, after that, when I'm launched in the series, the other books, I would say they take between 6 months and 1 year to write.
Fantastic. So what's next for you then? Because these books are already written and out there. What's your next project?
Well, I have another project, which is also science fiction, I'm working on right now, that will be published in France next year, and maybe one day in English too. I hope so.
Can you tell us any more about it?
Again, you know, I'm sorry. I like to keep the secrecy, or to at least some kind of mystery, to make it as a surprise for the readers. And the only thing I can say is that all my different series, I try to explore a different genre each time. So the first one, as I said, was urban fantasy. The second one was historical fantasy. Phobos is, we have a word in French, which is anticipation, which means science fiction that is set in a very near future. No, not in a far-fetched, very far future, like mm-hmm. Star Wars, for instance, but something that could happen tomorrow. Think, for instance, Black Mirror, the British TV yeah. series. That's really what I wanted to do in Phobos. And my new science fiction series, which will be my fourth series, will be something different again. Still science fiction, but another kind of science fiction.
Fantastic. Well, we look forward to that. But in the meantime, people can get a copy of Ascension, which is out now, followed by Distortion and Collision, all in the Phobos series. And they're all by Victor Dixon, who we've been chatting to today. Victor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is author G.J. Morgan. He's been a chef, a fashion graduate, and now works in finance. His unpublished novella, Miss B.T., has recently been adapted into a short film. His and her American classics are his debut novels. They're told from dual perspectives that span over two books. It's an emotionally driven love story. Welcome to the Book Show, Gareth.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks very much for joining us. And I'm interested about your unpublished novella made into a short film. That sounds exciting.
Oh, yeah, I kind of, I wrote that when my wife was pregnant. I just wanted to just write something short and sweet. So I just wrote a few short novellas. And it was just one that I just did as a bit. Never thought I'd publish it or do anything with it. But I sent it off to a competition, and one of my... someone in the BBC was really impressed with it and got some funding for it to be made into a short movie.
Oh, great stuff. Have you seen it then? Has it been done?
It's been edited. They're looking to get some funding for, because it deals with death and anxiety. So sounds a bit of a depressing read, but it's it's about a woman whose husband dies and she becomes addicted to ringing call centres. And they want to get some charity funding to sort of help boost it.
Yeah. Oh,
great. So hopefully it will be out later on in the year.
Okay. So tell us about your novels then. We've got His American Classic and Her American Classic. Why did you decide to write these novels kind of from dual perspectives over these two books?
Well, purely it was, I was telling the story of an actress in front of the camera and the paparazzi behind the lens, so it kind of felt as if both stories needed to be told to be fair to each of them. Though it did obviously give me a harder task, because technically I've got two voices, two journeys, and two books to write, literally in this sense. But yeah, if it just felt a case where you've got technically you've got a hero and a villain, and I wanted to make it more so the two of them merged, where you couldn't you the reader ended up kind of rooting for both. So I just sort of make both of them, give them both layers, make both of them complicated and not one dimensional.
So tell us about the actress then, Lily Goodridge.
So Lily is a young and fragile and famous actress in Hollywood, and she isn't coping very well with either of those things. So she decides to take on a film role across the other side of the world in a little quiet seaside town in Devon. So she's kind of run away. She's kind of run away from fame and horrible ex-boyfriends who are equally as famous. And then you've got Tom as well, who's a Brit abroad, a Hollywood tour guide, a father and a husband. And again, he's struggling with all three of those. And somehow, against his better judgment, he ends up becoming paparazzi. And Lily Goodridge is his first job.
And how does he change when he becomes paparazzi?
Well, he does it. It's a bit of a dilemma because he kind of knows that it's going against his morals to do that job. But it's put in a situation where he has to earn money in some way he can. And then he's kind of torn when he gets there by meeting her by watching her from afar. He starts become infatuated by her.
I see. And where did you get the idea from about this story?
Well, it was kind of a couple of things. Me and my wife got married back in 2009. And when we was on our honeymoon in Fiji, my wife fell pregnant. And what happened then is that we felt quite vulnerable because there was no doctors there. It was quite a basic island we were staying in. And then luckily we were going back to LA before we flew home. And when we was in LA, we did a sort of a celebrity house tour, and it was around the time that Michael Jackson died. So there was lots of celebrities and lots of media intrusion. And it got me just thinking about the strange relationship between celebrity and the fans, and sort of how strange it is that we really care about seeing inside someone's like kitchen or house. But at the same time, we know deep down that it doesn't feel right to have that level of intrusion.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Why do you, through writing this book, have you understood a little bit more as to why people are so interested in the lives of celebrities?
I just kind of looked at it as in what it must be like to be either, because you've got a celebrity who at the same time will want to post all their personal things on Instagram or Twitter, but then also wants their own privacy. So it's that kind of weird thing of they want to give you all of them, but they want to keep some of it back. It's a really unusual relationship, I think, between celebrity and fan base.
Yeah, a lot of people always say, you know, how can people want or demand their privacy when they are posting all these photos on Instagram? You know, some people would say they can't have both.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching a program that had sort of Brad Pitt was on there, and he was talking about his children, saying that his children have lived their lives thinking it's normal for 30 people to follow them everywhere they go every day. And they've never been to a cinema or been to a supermarket because they just can't do it. So it's kind of, it's really unusual how it must be to be in that amount of intrusion.
Yeah. For kids particularly, because they literally haven't asked for it.
Yeah, so it must be a weird concept thinking it's normal to have 30 people following everywhere you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, talking of people like Brad Pitt, there are, of course, many, many big A-list film stars who don't go on Instagram. There's a lot of big stars particularly who aren't posting pictures of what they're doing every day. I think there's a lot of stars who do want and do try to have that privacy as much as possible, but probably don't have much of it at all, as you say.
And that's similar to the character Lily in the book. She's the reason why she's running away. She's famous because of all the wrong things she's getting. She's getting photos taken of her coming out drunk or making silly mistakes. Her actual acting and what she's actually paid to do is not what's getting the headlines. It's all the bad things. So it's that thing of she's trying not to it, but people are so interested in her kind of losing her way as opposed to her being good at her profession.
Yeah, very sad. So what happens in his American classic then?
Well, it's that journey from Lily running away from America over to Devon and trying to sort of take on a small film role and just try and technically just keep out of everyone's way. but it's almost like the world wants to find her as well, so she can't really escape. So all the paparazzi trying to find this actress, which is sort of who's gone off the radar, and it's almost a bit of a competition to who can find Lily and who can take the first photo with her. So it's a bit of a competition between the paparazzi to find her first. Mm. And that's where Tom comes in, and he's trying to be the first to find her, and eventually he does, and it's a kind of, he starts to realise that actually she's not the person that everyone's portraying her to be.
Yeah. And what about her American classic then? What happens in that one?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but let's just say that Tom and Lily actually, they cross the boundary between being paparazzi and celebrity and actually end up actually physically meeting each other.
Okay.
And it's that relationship where two enemies technically become more than that, become friends, and maybe even more.
Mm-hmm. Great. So were you writing the books simultaneously, or did you write one before the other?
I actually wrote them as one ginormous book. And then when I was looking into getting it published, I kind of realised that it's actually a bit too big for one book. I think it'd scare people off. But luckily it's got a kind of a natural middle and sort of a natural cliffhanger. So it felt ideal to sort of split it into a part one and part two.
Okay. So do you recommend that people read his before her then?
Yeah, so the pink one, so his is the first, and the blue one's the second.
Okay. And have you written more since?
I have started, well, funny enough, when I actually finished writing this novel, I think it was about a year and a half ago, but I felt because it had taken me about four and a half, five years to actually write it, because it had just been a slow process, that by that point I felt I just needed to do something completely different. So I actually wrote something completely different. I ended up writing a TV series, funny enough. Don't ask me why, but it just felt I wanted to write something completely against the genre that I'd just written. So it was a bit of a gritty TV series with swear words and boobs in it, essentially. And it was almost like I'd overdosed on chick flicks. I needed a bit of Jason Statham.
And did you enjoy that one more?
I think I did, because it kind of, because I've been spending 5 years writing about a complex love story, I kind of felt like I need to sort of go back to sort of almost like writing like a manly thing, and almost just completely changing it and going back more to, I suppose the way I was describing it, just more writing a TV series meant I could just focus purely on dialogue, as opposed to writing scenes or landscapes. I could just focus on people speaking to each other.
Mm.
So it was the exact opposite of what I'd just written for 5 years.
Yeah. And do you find that the idea of writing a script easier than writing a novel, regardless of the subject?
I did, if I'm being honest, I did enjoy the TV series more than I thought I would. I think I actually enjoyed it more than the novel in a strange way. Although a lot of people who have read the book, His and Hers, have said that when you read it, it's like you're watching a film, and every person says that this should be a movie. It's got a kind of a Notting Hill, Dirty Dancing kind of feel to it. It's that kind of, it just feels like it should be on a big screen. So maybe the novel is quite heavily dialogue based as well, as a lot of it is two characters speaking. So maybe that's just been the way I've written since the beginning.
Mm. Well, if people want to get a copy of the books, they're called His American Classic and Her American Classic. They're by G.J. Morgan, who we've been chatting to today. Thank you very much for joining us, Gareth, and good luck with the books.
Oh, thank you.
TRE, TRE, TRE. Talk Radio Europe.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Australia is Shelley Unwin. She's a children's picture book author and has put together a series of five picture books, Your One to Your Five, or the Your series as they're known as. And they all came out last year. And now this year she's brought out a non-fiction picture book called Blast Off. Welcome to the show, Shelley.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here chatting to you.
It's great to have you with us. And I have to say, I think your series is a fantastic idea.
Thank you. Thank you. I was working towards being an author for about 2.5 years before I had that idea. And I'd done lots of courses and been to lots of networking functions and things. And sort of got to know quite a few publishers and things who were all really interested in my writing, but I hadn't come up with the right story idea to get published. And this was a story idea that actually came to me at 11 o'clock at night, and I'd been asleep and I sat bolt upright and I'm like, oh my goodness, I've got it. And it was Your Five, actually, was the first book that came to mind. And the idea of it not being milestone-based, but just about the joy of five and the number five and all of the interesting things in the world that are about five, but that would feel to a child being read to that that it's all about them. So, it was wonderful to think of a commercial idea that the publishers would also be interested in. That was this one. Yeah.
Fantastic. So in Your Five, then, using that as an example, what kind of things are you talking about that refer to the number five?
Yeah, so there's five vowels, five oceans surrounding the lands. It's all written in verse. Five fingers on a hand. I wish I had one in front of me now, but it's more bigger concepts by five. So Your One starts with one tummy to tickle, one head to shake, and one little mouth for eating cake. So all the ideas in Your One are very egocentric and what a little one-year-old would be interested in.
Yeah.
And then as you go up by Your Three, you've got things like triceratops and tricycles and triangles and all sorts of things that that three-year-olds would be attached to. And then by five, you've got some of the school readiness ideas, like five questions to ask and five oceans. So it sort of develops with the child's interests and with the child's abilities. But by the time, if you've read Your One to a one-year-old for a year, they really know the number. But they just think it's a book that's all about them and they get to read it. And then they look forward to turning two so they can get the next book in the series. And so, yeah, it's a very exciting. And I love one of my friends has got a little one-year-old, and she says when she's reading that book to her, she gets ready to tickle her tummy before she turns the next page where it says one tummy to tickle, which just makes smile. It's just everything that is to me. To hear something like that from something I've written is just the world, you know?
Oh, absolutely. You can see it really working for parents like that. And also, of course, for the little ones. I think it's a great idea. And they must love the pictures as well. There's beautiful illustrations in the books.
Oh, how lucky did I get to be paired with Catherine Battersby. She's just incredible. And she's done a couple of other books, The Squish Rabbit books and Little Wing, which I equally love. Like, her style, she's so simplistic, and yet, you know, her characters don't necessarily have mouths, and but from the eyes and the droop of the ears, you know exactly what her characters are feeling. It's just incredible. She's such a talent. I saw the all five came back as storyboards, and I instantly fell in love with everything that she'd done, and there wasn't really anything that I sort of suggested that we put more clocks into the books or, you know, little tiny things. But really, with the style and her ideas, because I wasn't sure in Your One, there's one moon at night and one sun in the daytime shining bright. And I didn't know how she was going to illustrate that at all. I hadn't got any idea in my own mind of how to do that. And she's done a beautiful earth mobile hanging over a cot. And it's she just has nailed it all the way through. She's incredible.
That's very clever. And so they all came out last year. Any plans for Your Six, or are we definitely stopping at five?
No, definitely stopping at five. There is some sort of ideas around a You're Here for a brand new baby.
Oh, lovely.
Which would be, the beginning of the series, because I think that also to celebrate the arrival is a really special time too. So I have put some words together for that. I'm just waiting to hear. We've had some very exciting news, actually, in the last week, and I can't say yet who it's with, because it's not, I haven't got the paperwork back, but we've had an offer and verbally accepted an offer from a US publisher to take the Your One and Your Two of the series. So that's incredible news for me.
Yeah. Like, congratulations.
I'm thrilled to hear that. Yeah. So it was a big week last week celebrating.
And there's a new book out this year. It came out in April, a non-fiction picture book called Blast Off. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so it's a narrative nonfiction. So it takes the reader on a journey through space, visiting each of the eight planets. And something funny hurts. So at the first the first planet is Mercury. Mercury is mega hot and closest to the sun. You couldn't visit Mercury. The heat would burn your bum. So it's child humor, but they're learning about the positioning of the planet.
Definitely.
And, you know, the fact that it's a really hot planet. And then at the back, we've got supporting fun facts. So you learn why it's a hot planet. And if with each planet, the fact that is in the verse is then elaborated on in the fun facts at the back. So I'm having such a ball doing school visits with Blast Off. So I turn all of the children into little astronauts in training, and I have them up doing star jumps and testing their balance and testing their reflex skills and things before they're allowed to come on a journey into space with me. And I did it with 400 children last Friday, and they were absolutely fantastic. It was so much fun. It's such a great topic, space, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think things like this that you can learn with so much fun when you're younger, you remember them for the rest of your life. And it really does set you up education-wise. I've always been fascinated by the planets and out of space. And I remember from a very young age learning at school when Pluto was a planet, mind. Morning journey starts under Nelson's piano. And that's
mine
the order of
my
the planets.
Very eager mother. Sorry.
And what
was my very eager mother just served up new potatoes.
Oh, I like that. I've not heard that one before. That's brilliant.
But it doesn't work anymore because there's no potatoes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, mine, if you change it, it sounds a bit odd that you wouldn't really want to say to kids, my very early morning journey starts under Nelson. It's not quite the same, is it?
Brilliant. No,
I think they should teach that in schools. Who's Nelson, mummy? Oh, I don't know. So, is there going to be a sort of follow-up to this, or this is a standalone book?
Oh, well, now again, I have written something. I met with my publisher today, actually, and there's a potential for Dive In, which is the same concept but visiting all the oceans around the world, which again is, it's funny, there's humor woven in and then lots of facts to learn. So you just don't know with publishing, obviously, you have to sort of learn a whole new level of patience and just keep everything crossed. But I've got another book coming out in October with Alan and Unwin again, which is called There's a Baddie Running Through This Book. Which is a very cool chase. And I've got Vivian Toe illustrating that, who is the most amazing up-and-coming new illustrator. She's done one book with Margaret Wilde, who's a very prolific Australian author, and won quite a few awards for newcomer illustrator awards, which is very exciting. But with this book, she actually gets the baddie to rip from the page what he steals from each character. And as he runs through the book, each character joins in the chase until he gets to the end and he's locked up in jail. And you can see him just ripping away the corner of the jail cell. So he's going to be on the loose and on the run again. So it's, it's really, and that's all prepositions, you know, did he go up or down, in or out, around or through, those sorts of things. Seemed to manage to get a sneaky bit of learning.
Yeah. It must be so much fun putting these books together though for you.
It is. And it really doesn't feel like work. I feel very spoiled that I get to call this work. And going into schools and sharing it with the children and seeing them get so engaged and invested in what you've written, it's like, wow, how did I score this as a job? Yeah. I mean, it's just incredible. Beautiful. And, you know, I tinker with a few longer things as well. And I just think to be able to play with words all week, it's just a blessing.
That must be the best thing as an author, to get that feedback from your audience, especially when they're excitable children, instead of just, you know, writing the book and seeing how many people buy it and go, okay, well, that's good. I hope they enjoyed it, you know, and just never really knowing. That must be very weird.
That's right. And because you don't, and there's no, there's no sort of instant feedback on sales and things either. That's a really long time frame. You get your sort of royalties reports a year and a half after that's happened. So you don't really get to see how things are tracking from a live basis. But in schools, seeing the children, seeing them respond, seeing them with their hands in the air, wanting to talk to you and wanting to stay back afterwards to tell you a little something they know about space. And it's just, it's so gratifying. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think it's a really good reason to do it. I think that was one of the things. I've sort of found little gaps in the market with the space book. My son Harrison, when he was 3, was really fascinated with space, but the nonfiction books from the library, it couldn't hold him. You know, there were too many facts in there for him to sit and listen to. We'd do about a page and then he'd want a story. So I wanted to combine a really fun story with facts so that they could actually learn. And it's like you say, when they're kids, they learn everything. Like they just take it all in like a sponge.
Yeah.
And then you get to our age and it, well, you might be younger than me, but I find it so hard to learn new things now. I'm like, I'm going to commit that to memory. And then I'm like, what am I committing to memory?
Yeah, exactly.
It's gone already.
So no, it's much easier to absorb information at a young age, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it is. It all goes in. It's incredible. Make it fun whilst they're doing it, then all the better.
Yeah, definitely. If people want more information about all your books, they can have a look on your website. Is that the best way?
Yes. So www.shellyunwin.com. Book Depository, deliver.
Okay.
To Europe.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Book Depository. Shelley, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to chat with you, and I think it's brilliant what you're doing.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Hannah. Thanks for your time.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.